join me in welcoming Honourable Bill English to the podium.
Thank you very much, Graeme, for the introduction. In the reference to the superannuation portability, this time last week I was in Brisbane getting over a night of excitement at the State of Origin game. I was in a box full of Queenslanders, the only one who had bet on New South Wales because they're blue. The crowd was getting nasty at losing the fight as well as losing the game. But rugby league is a bit of an entree in Australia. I had a formal bilateral with Wayne Swan, which is a three-hour discussion about the excitement of the single economic market. And we spent the first hour discussing the history of rugby league in Queensland. And everything went fine after that. But it was very useful over there in Australia to be reminded of just how much practical business interaction there is between New Zealand and Australia. And we need to match that with political interaction. And in fact, we are getting to the stage now where a trip by a cabinet minister to Australia is going to be classified as a domestic flight rather than an international one. And that just reflects the reality that probably most weeks the cabinet has a minister in Australia, and some weeks two or three, because we need to clear the way for the ease of doing business on both sides of the Tasman. There's a few facts there that come up which I think we need to keep in mind. Australia has about $85 billion of investment in New Zealand, easily our largest overseas investor. And, of course, we need to take good care of that. We've just celebrated 1 million visitors from Australia to New Zealand. First time we've reached 1 million visitors in a 12-month period. So the degree of interaction is continuing. Quite a lot of discussion there about the progress of their economy and some discussion about the comparison between the two. And we had one simple message for the Australian politicians, which was that whatever works for Australia works for us. So while we may be keen to close up the gap with Australia, their success is pretty important in our success. And because the economy has understandably been the government's top priority here, I don't need to tell you about the impacts of the global recession, but I will say that the impact of these events of the last 12 months or so will be felt in New Zealand for some time. The public finance cycle is about 15 years. So in the mid-2020s, we'll be living with the effects of decisions made now. Today, I'd like to walk through our economic plan and why we've taken some of the decisions that we've taken, and outline some details of the plan, particularly around overseas investment, which indicate the direction that the government is going in. When the government took office, it had some pretty immediate priorities. It was apparent that the speed and the scale of recession had caught all economic forecasters by surprise. And certainly the government's forecasters. Every new set of data earlier this year painted a bleaker picture. Just to give you an example of how far the outlook has changed, in the budget 2008, the forecast for the year ending March 2010 was that the economy would grow by 2.3%. That's what was forecast just 12 months ago. By budget 2009, the forecasts are 1.7% contraction. So a 4% turnaround in growth, which is, in anyone's language, dramatic. I think it's important, though, to look back further than that to understand what's happened in New Zealand. Around about 2003-2004, things started getting out of kilter. Bank credit and household debt started blowing out at double-digit annual rates 5 years ago. Non-tradables inflation took off and has been at around 4% since then, while tradable inflation, inflation in the parts of the economy exposed to international competition, has been close to zero. Government spending really started picking up 5 years ago. It's ballooned by 50% in the last 5 years, double the rate of economic growth, and double the rate of growth in our revenue. Public sector wages started blowing out in 2003-2004, and since then our productivity growth has sunk to a 25-year low. So we have a picture here of an economy that was headed into trouble before the global recession, as signalled by the fact that we started having our own recession well before the global recession. And there's two worrying indicators that we now are left with from this lopsided economy. First, the tradable sector. Now that's our, the exporters or industries that are competing with imports. It's actually been in recession for 5 years. Our tradable sector has contracted by 10% over the last 5 years. That's a stark contrast with the non-tradable sector, which is domestic industries not competing with exports, the government, construction, finance and retail. It has grown by 15% in the last 5 years. So the export sector has been in recession, contracted by 10%, and the domestic sector has grown by 15%. And even more staggering, in the tradable part of the economy, there have been no net new jobs for 10 years. So this economy has indeed become addicted to borrowing and consumption funded by that borrowing. And just when we need to grow our export sector, it's flat on its back. The second symptom of the imbalances in the economy are the deep red ink flowing through the government accounts. On current forecasts, our deficit will persist at around 5% of GDP for the next 4 years. That's around $8 billion deficits for the next 4 years. With cash deficits, that's the bit that we need to fund by borrowing, around 10 to 12 billion. Now that's why our public debt is going to grow by over 40 billion in the next 4 years. It will more than double. These deficits are, to make an understatement, a bit larger than we had foreseen. They are in fact significantly larger than they were in the late 80s and early 90s. This deficit problem is much harder to solve than the deficit problem we had at the time of that fairly significant restructuring. So they will require significant policy decisions and some collective buy-in. It's 10 years until the government's books show a surplus. So I explain to people, it's like having a large overdraft that's going to take you 10 years to clear, and you have no choices about going on holiday until you've done it. That could look like a long, demoralising trudge. At the same time, unemployment is rising and will continue to rise over the next year or so, even when the economy starts to recover. The government has set about to take the sharpest edges off unemployment through a rolling program of targeted policies that give New Zealanders the best chance of keeping their job or finding a new one. And of course, we are supporting thousands of jobs with that $40 billion borrowing program. There's no free lunch here, though. We have deliberately rejected calls for a reckless spend-up that would see government debt skyrocket out of control, which would have lengthened the recession and, in the long run, cost thousands of jobs rather than created them. So Budget 2009 took significant steps towards managing the immediate impacts of the recession. It got the government's finances in order and brought debt under control. We will now see gross government debt peaking at around 43% of GDP rather than the original forecasts in February, where government debt never peaked, it just kept on rising off the end of the page. We protected the most vulnerable by maintaining welfare entitlements. We've actually increased government spending by almost $3 billion in this financial year. This increase in spending is entirely appropriate to help cushion the impact of the recession now, but of course it cannot continue indefinitely. We are entering a period of permanent restraint. Growth in spending will be much lower in next year's budget, and it will stay low for the foreseeable future. That is why the government sector needs to focus on providing better, smarter services for without new money. The public sector represents about a third of the economy, and in the last 10 years it has been a drag on productivity. So it must contribute to the recovery through the government lifting the productivity of that 30% of the economy it controls directly, and ensuring that it doesn't stifle business investment and suck resources which could be creating sustainable jobs in the private sector. We believe Budget 2009 struck about the right balance between dealing with the short-term impacts of recession and the immediate challenges, but setting out on the larger task of a 3 to 5 year program of the road to recovery. The Prime Minister spoke last week about three challenges the New Zealand economy faces: increasing our productivity growth, maintaining high levels of employment, reducing our vulnerability to adverse events. It is important that we reduce New Zealand's vulnerability to future shocks. We've had a recession roughly once every 10 years, 1978, 1988, 1998. You'd think we might have been able to see one coming in 2008. But with the world the way it is, you'd have to be a mug to think there won't be more shocks. These three challenges need to be addressed urgently. I might say there is no single silver bullet here. Those who are looking for one big idea or a vision which fixes these problems won't find it. Much of what we have to do is unglamorous, and I make no apologies for that. The government's program is focused on boosting productivity and competitiveness. It is particularly focused on giving businesses the confidence to invest, because it's only when business invests that we create sustainable jobs and reduce our unemployment. I just want to run through the six elements of our policy program, some in more detail than others, because they will form the core, not the whole of, but the core of our economic program over the next 3 to 5 years. Close to your hearts will be regulatory reform. Businesses complained about red tape. We're getting on with and working with Regulatory Reform Minister Rodney Hyde on a busy program to rewrite a lot of significant regulatory legislation over the next 2 years. This includes the Overseas Investment Act, the Resource Management Act, the Building Act, the Holidays Act, a review of the electricity market, review of telecommunications regulation, and of course a review and replacement of the emissions trading legislation. I think we would agree that that collection of regulation has a pervasive influence on the economy and on business investment decisions. Today I'd like to particularly focus on the overseas investment rules. Overseas as an investment is important because New Zealand relies on it to provide businesses with capital to grow, create jobs, and bring new technologies and skills from overseas. As I've said, we have $85 billion of Australian investment here in New Zealand. In the world of tight credit, we are competing now more than ever for overseas capital. And until New Zealanders dramatically change their savings habits, we will be competing for overseas capital. So it's particularly important that that our investment screening regime does not deter valuable overseas investment. Our screening regime has a powerful signalling effect to those who might want to invest in New Zealand. Our overseas investment rules should achieve three objectives. They should address public concerns, requiring overseas investors to meet additional requirements to those of domestic investors. They should be simple. That is, simple to understand and to implement. And our overseas investment rules should be predictable, providing certainty for investors who enter the process in good faith. On that basis, the case for reviewing our overseas investment rules is compelling. Since 2002, 98% of all overseas investment applications have been approved. 98% of all overseas investment applications have been approved. But they are all tied up in a complex process that takes far too long, that risks putting off investors who can, of course, take their capital elsewhere. Most overseas investment applications are for sensitive land, some of which is tied to business transactions. Yet some types of land we currently screen for are not obviously sensitive. For example, it's not clear that an investment in a retirement home next to a sports field should face the same scrutiny as a high country station or land that provides access to our national parks. New Zealand's international reputation as a place to invest has also been undermined by previous policy changes at short notice. We need to restore our credibility and show that New Zealand will deal with investors fairly and with certainty. Today I can report we've made good progress in reviewing our overseas investment rules. First, we have decided the Overseas Investment Office, rather than ministers, can decide on a greater proportion of the applications. This is expected to reduce the number of applications considered by ministers by around 40%. In fact, this change has been in place for a couple of months. Second, certain types of transactions will be exempt from requiring consent under the Overseas Investment Act. For instance, someone who already owns 50% of a company and wants to expand their interest to 60 or 70%. This will reduce the number of minor and technical applications that result in little or no change to overseas control or ownership. The previous government had agreed to a number of these exemptions, and it's important that we move on them. Finally, officials are completing work on how the Overseas Investment Act itself can be improved, with the advice of a reference group from senior partners of a number of major law firms. There are three main areas of the Act itself, as opposed to the regulations, that we are looking to improve. We're looking at whether the thresholds determining which land and business investments are screened are set at the right level, so that only genuinely sensitive assets are captured. When 98% of applications are approved, clearly we're dealing with a wide range of assets that are not genuinely sensitive. Secondly, we want to provide more certainty for investors by removing the ability to change the overseas investment rules while applications are in front of the government, avoiding the situation we saw last year with the Auckland Airport. Third, we're looking to considerably simplify the screening of investments in sensitive land. An investor in sensitive land currently gets screened against 27 different criteria. We will make sure that overseas investors are subject to a higher standard than domestic investors on issues such as public access to land, but that they should not be required to meet further arbitrary requirements of government departments. We also want to ensure that all the relevant domestic legislation is used to address New Zealand interests in an overseas investment. We are looking at removing the strategic asset test from the overseas investment regime. No one has ever been sure what a strategic asset was, and it created considerable confusion and uncertainty. Our own stock take has shown that unique assets, where overseas investment might pose a risk to New Zealand consumers, are either protected by their own restrictions, such as ownership restrictions in telecom, or are already in public ownership, such as our energy companies. As a final reserve power, we will consider a new national interest test, similar to that used in other countries. This will provide certainty for investors, balanced with safeguarding the ultimate interests of New Zealand. A national interest test is very rarely used, but it does allow a government, on the basis of credible evidence, to decline an investment application where this is necessary to protect vital economic interests and where those concerns can't be addressed under existing rules. This is a pretty high hurdle. The government will consider recommendations for any legislative changes in the next few weeks, and we will look to introduce any agreed changes in September and hope to pass them by the end of this year. The public will be consulted through the select committee process, and I know there are a number of groups interested in this law, and they should put their views forward. The changes we are making strike the right balance between making overseas investments simpler and more attractive while still protecting New Zealanders' legitimate and strong interests in its most sensitive land and assets. So the Overseas Investment Act review is one part of an extensive program of regulatory review. And I'll just take you through the other five aspects of our policy program quickly. I've said already that we have an obligation to provide better, smarter public services. We made a good start in the budget by saving around $2 billion over the next 4 years while boosting frontline services in health and education and law and order. But we need to make enduring and permanent change in the public sector. Restraint is now permanent. The public service cannot wait out this particular fiscal problem, nor can the public vote it away. If we are to meet the legitimate demands and expectations of so many New Zealanders who are reliant on public services, then we will have to think about better ways of delivering those services. In fact, we owe it to those who are dependent on public services to apply the best of our professionalism and innovation to delivering better public services. While there will be those who talk about privatisation and cuts, those words have become a label for a mindset that says nothing has changed and the public sector should be protected from the global recession. That lets down all those people who will ultimately miss out on a service if we don't change the way that we deliver them. A third policy program is investing in productive infrastructure. We have seen a big upsurge in investment in infrastructure in recent years in New Zealand, and the government has allocated considerable resources to lifting it further. The core of that investment program is in roads and energy transmission and broadband. Our first step has been to set up the machinery to handle the government part of that investment to make sure we are doing it better. Earlier this year, we established a national infrastructure unit, which will, in the next few months, publish the first national infrastructure plan. We're investing around $7.5 billion over the next 5 years, and we've made it clear that the government is open to do business with the private sector to improve the management of public assets. The government has around $100 billion of hard assets. While we're interested in PPPs, they will only ever be at the margin with respect to new investment. But we do want to import those skills from the private sector that focus on managing risks and innovative financing, which are going to allow us to manage the other $100 billion of assets we already own much better. I spent some time in Queensland last week talking to public and private sector organisations about how the Queensland government has managed its infrastructure investment, and a number of New Zealand businesses were represented there. The fourth part of the program focuses on education and skills. We are introducing national standards in literacy and numeracy. Each year, around 20% of the young New Zealanders who leave school and enter the workforce do not have the basic competencies of literacy and numeracy that are needed either to be good citizens or to take part in the workforce. So we want to start early with clear standards about what is expected of our students and our schools, and plain English reporting of their progress to parents. Again, there are some who believe this may be too demanding. We think it is vital. We're also going to be introducing a scheme called the Youth Guarantee, which will focus on New Zealand's 16 and 17-year-olds to make sure that they have full flexibility in how they gain the qualifications that they need. We will be announcing details soon of a staged rollout of the Youth Guarantee beginning next year. A fifth aspect of our policy program is innovation and business assistance. This is essentially the funding that is overseen by our research, science and technology organisations, and New Zealand Trade and Enterprise. We want to promote a stronger relationship between the business sector, the government and our publicly funded research institutions. Some valuable lessons have been learnt over the last 10 years about how this can be done better. We want to build on what works and stop doing what doesn't work. The final part of our policy program will focus on a world-class tax system. As a starting point, we want a tax system that rewards effort, provides better incentives to get ahead, and allows our businesses to thrive. We need a tax system that helps New Zealand become more competitive, but at the same time preserves the necessary revenue flows. As we face a decade of fiscal deficits, it is vital that we resist the temptation to lift tax rates. Within a matter of a few years, it'll be one of our comparative advantages that we are a country that has not lifted its tax rates. But we do need an efficient mechanism for raising revenue. The government's medium-term goal remains aligning the top personal, company and trustee tax rates at 30%. That will clearly be challenging. We have set up a tax working group chaired by Victoria University Professor Bob Buckle, working with Treasury and the IRD and tax experts to consider the challenges that are facing New Zealand. One reason alone that we must consider these issues in a pretty basic way is the fact that the Australian government has set up the Henry Review. It is taking a comprehensive view of tax. They're looking at changes in the tax mix, new tax bases. We want to be quite sure we won't be caught flat-footed if the Australians unexpectedly do something clever. The Henry Review is due to report back at the end of this year, and it will certainly influence our thinking. Our overriding aim is to remain competitive with other countries and use good tax policy as a way of lifting economic performance. So these six policy areas will drive the government's economic direction over the next 3 to 5 years. Regulatory reform, better public sector performance, investment in infrastructure, education standards, business and innovation, and tax. You can see we are clear about what needs to be done. We have a balanced and effective plan to turn the economy round. In particular, we want to make sure we turn the generalities about productivity and economic growth into particular decisions. We are a government who don't have a lot of time for discussions about further analysis of the problems. What we are keen to hear about are particular decisions about particular issues that can be implemented so they make a difference. And we have a good deal of confidence that New Zealand can come out of this recession in better shape than most countries. The main reason for that confidence is the resilience that so many New Zealanders have demonstrated in the face of recession. I can recall the recession of the late 80s and early 90s. At that time, many New Zealanders were paralysed by the scale of change that they faced. They did not know what to do. This time, they do. They're rolling up their sleeves and pragmatically getting on and doing what they need to do. New Zealanders chose a path at the election that backed enterprise and innovation and opportunity and the leadership of John Key as Prime Minister. The economic program I have outlined today will assist in delivering on the success that New Zealanders are looking for. Thank you.
Stay there, Bill. thanks very much indeed. Now, we do have just a few moments for one or two questions. If you have a question, please stand and say your name. We have a microphone somewhere in the room there with Paula. Yes, I can see it. So, are there any questions for the Deputy Prime Minister? Well, perhaps Bill, I might just start off. Are you going to the Trans-Tasman Leadership Forum in the end of August? I think you might be there. And what are the main things that you hope to get out of the that meeting in Sydney at the end of August?
Well, I suppose that the first thing is I hope that the Trans-Tasman Leadership Forum moves on a bit from the strong diplomatic focus that it's had, where there's politicians spending a lot of time talking about our ANZAC relationship as if we weren't sure about it or something, and move on to a practical interaction, particularly with Australian business. You know, the piece that's sometimes missing for New Zealand politicians is understanding what's driving the Australian decision makers who have an impact on our economy. And I would hope that the Leadership Forum is an opportunity to talk with them. The signs are the Australians take the forum quite seriously. They sent a big group of ministers and serious business leaders to the one here in Wellington last time, we're certainly sending a good team there this time, and I hope we'll get more of the interaction between New Zealand politicians and Australian business.
Now, I think we might have had a question just down there in the middle. Is that correct or not? No? One at the back here.
Hi. Lance Stevens from Commonwealth. Bill, you've clearly set a wonderful agenda, speaking on behalf of myself. I think it's great, and I would summarise that voters went to the election last year looking for change and voting for an aspirational society, and you're clearly providing that. So thanks. My question is more just in terms of the general economy. Financial markets have clearly reacted to strong leading indicators. The real economy, as we know, does lag financial markets. I guess, are there risks, I guess, to your conservative forecasts going out the next year or two?
Yes, there certainly are risks. The Treasury's forecasts are reasonably conservative. They're kind of at the bottom end of the consensus, but they're not way out of line. I think the risk, I'd put the risk this way. We've had a lot of fiscal stimulus in New Zealand, same in Australia. And I think what could happen is that the initial phase of recovery is a stimulus-driven one. When actually in the long run that's not what we want. So the initial phases look like they could be a pickup in the housing market, a New Zealand dollar that's reasonably strong, and people getting out and spending a bit more, and maybe borrowing a bit more. Now, that's not what the mix we want in the long term. In the longer term, of course, we want a dollar that permits a strong export surge. We want people focusing on saving and investing, and we want less consumption. So, you know, the road to recovery is going to have a few twists in it, and I suspect we'll get a phase of stimulus-driven recovery. Politicians are then going to have to do what we've all said we'd do, and which is actually pull back on their stimulus. Certainly that's what the Australians are saying they're doing, it's what we've said we're doing in the budget. You plug it in for a while and then you have to stop. And there's going to be a critical period there as we transit into the long-term rebalancing that the economy needs. And it is just a bit hard to pick that path. I don't think anyone 3 months ago would have picked a 66 cent New Zealand dollar. I think it is probably becoming a bit more evident to us that the US dollar isn't going to be a strong and vigorous currency when they're out there borrowing $1 trillion. And the Chinese are in the newspaper every week saying they want something done about it. So there's a lot of uncertainties out ahead of us. we have to do what we can control and not worry too much about the uncontrollable things. And that list I went through is the stuff that we can control and actually get on and do.
Thanks very much indeed, Bill. Now, I know we've got to get you away, and you're right. The Deputy Prime Minister's got enough time for a couple more questions. There's one down here in the front. I see a hand up the back as well. Fran? Up this
one. Bill, give me your comment around increasing public sector performance.
If you just introduce yourself.
Steve Griffin, EDS, HP. And listening to John Whitehead's comments, recent comments yesterday, which can be paraphrased as sort of do it to yourself before it demunting. You would indicate, you figure from that, that the pace of change and the pace of innovation isn't really satisfactory. Are you looking at providing sort of stimulus to increase that pace of change?
Okay, well, I'll just describe how we're approaching our bit of the economy. You need to remember that it's pretty difficult to sell conflicting messages to the public, and it's pretty difficult to execute conflicting policy. So at a time when the focus is on maintaining spending by borrowing, it's a bit complicated at the same time to say we're also cutting everything back. So the reality, to deal with the reality we've found ourselves with becoming a government, we've had a six-month period up to the budget, which was about reacting to the financial crisis, getting on top of debt before it spiralled out of control, and cleaning up the fiscal loose ends from the last government, and a public sector getting used to just a different style of government after, you know, the change after a decade. And then we've been quite open with the leadership of the public sector saying, right, we'll focus on the six-month period, get all that stuff done, which is essentially backward-looking. Know, implementing commitments made 18 months ago before the recession even started. But we've done all that, and now we're setting a framework for the next 3 to 5 years, and we're deliberately taking the view that we want to go down a path where the public service own change. We don't want to go down the path where they sit back and say, well, wasn't it lovely when we had a Labor government that gave us lots of money, and here we've got these smash-and-grab conservatives who rip savings out of us. That's not how it's going to work, because that doesn't work. And that is why it's great to see someone like John Whitehead giving a speech like that, because it is about the public service understanding this is not going to go away, that if you're going to be a chief executive in the public service or a senior manager, the skill you must have now is the ability to conceptualise and execute change. And significant change, not just getting rid of an odd little committee you're getting sick of going to, but change, fundamentally altering the way that you do business with the public. Now that does take a bit of time, so we are maintaining spending. That has the, for macroeconomic reasons, it has the effect in the public sector that they've still got a pretty strong cash inflow, but we've signalled quite clearly that from next year's budget the lid comes down, and that gives them a bit of time to react to the change in government, the drastic change in outlook, and get themselves tooled up. Because I'd have to say, in my interactions with the public service, the skills that have served them well in the last 10 years are not the skills or tools that will serve them well in the next 10 years. And we want to make change that will stick, not change that unravels or can just get pushed back because the deficit ticks up a bit, you know, and suddenly everyone decides that the problem's over. So it is a bit of a slower process that fits our macroeconomic needs and reflects the reality that fast change imposed on the current public service would create chaos because they have not in any kind of mode to deal with that. However, the signs are that the leadership of the public service understand those messages, that they are starting to think longer term, looking at the skill sets, and I think you're going to see the pace of change pick up. And there's a few people squawking on the sideline about it, but you know, the rest of the community is in a very pragmatic mood. If you've just taken a 10% pay cut or gone on the 9-day fortnight or had to sell your investment house because your husband lost their job, then you're pretty keen to see the public service take their share of the burden. And I think that privileged feel that the public service has had for a decade is gone. And in the end, this is about the service for the public, not the providers of it. And we have to do whatever we can to maintain and lift the service to the public. The fact is that when they've had 50% growth in expenditure in 5 years, there's plenty of fat there. So we don't need to put a whole lot more money in if we start using the resources that are currently available.
Now, one last question from Frank.
Hi, Fran Sullivan, Comest. Just coming back to the overseas investment rule changes, I wonder, Minister, whether you could give some, perhaps an example of how the national interest test might apply?
Well, I can't think of one. And that's why it is a high-level test that we imagine will be very rarely used. I think that's the answer to your question. I mean, it may be that someone somehow gets to buy an asset like the Cook Strait cable, which you could, that's unique, and someone else owning it could be a risk to New Zealand's interest. It happens to be owned by Transpower and will remain forever in Crown ownership. So it won't be that one. And I guess that's the point, that when you go through the list of vital assets, they've either got their own protections, like telecom, or the banks, which are vital, they're not owned by us, but they're subject to our regulatory regime. And then you've got things like Transpower, which are in public ownership, energy generators. You know, you can argue about which particular assets you think are very strategic. Essentially, our message is, let's stop being defensive. Right? Let's tell the world we're open for business. This is a great place to invest, not a place that's going to say, well, you look different from us, so we're going to make it as hard as possible. When we get to 8% unemployment, this is going to become urgent. You think a kid on the, you know, a 19-year-old on the dole who by then has never had a job is going to say, well, no, I'm not going to work for someone who's an overseas investor. Those awful, Transfield people from Australia. I'll turn that job down because I'd rather work for the Gore District Council. You know, it doesn't work like that. It's going to be vital to get equity because credit's going to be difficult, particularly in a country that won't save. Right? New Zealanders don't want overseas investment. They should just start locking away 20% of their income each week. And then we won't have to put up with the stuff. But let's get practical. We need the money because we need the jobs. And we're going to tell the world we're open for business. We are going to look after the legitimate concerns of New Zealanders around, you know, things that really matter to them, particularly land and large business assets.
Thank you, Bill. You've been very generous with your time, and I know we all do appreciate it, and I hope you get back in time for question time. But